Hello, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. I am John Cryer, and this is the podcast about all things undisclosed. Now, I, like you, have been an avid listener of Undisclosed, and this is my chance and yours to get questions answered directly from the Undisclosed team. Now, I don't know about you, but I was losing my mind waiting for the new season, and it did not disappoint. Season 2 of Undisclosed tells the story of the state versus Joey Watkins, a man who spent 16 years in prison in Georgia for the murder of Isaac Dawkins, but who may well be wrongfully convicted. Now, with us today are two of the Undisclosed team and a very special guest. First, I want to introduce Susan Simpson. Everybody say it with me. She's an associate at the Volkov Law Group and blogs at The View from LL2. Hey, Susan, how you doing?
Good.
All right. I also want to welcome Colin Miller, who you might have heard is an associate dean and professor of law at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he blogs at Evidence Prof Blog. There. But our very special guest for this very first addenda episode is U.S. Representative Keith Ellison. He is from the 5th Congressional District in Minnesota. He is co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus and a longtime criminal defense attorney. Welcome to the show, Keith Ellison.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, you guys.
Oh, so glad. And I just want to take a moment to thank you, because I know it's been a horrific week of violence in the national news. And after the deaths of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile and the mass shooting of police officers in Dallas, I did want to make time to talk to you later on the show about that stuff and the many urgent issues that brings up. But thanks so much for making time for us.
Really a pleasure. And, you know, talking about issues of justice and our criminal sanction system is not only fascinating to me, it's also a little therapeutic, because I think that your show, Undisclosed, is critical in helping create public awareness about how we get to a system that we can all have confidence in, that is fair, just, and is something that the American people can have real confidence in.
Well, we will get to that and digging into episode one. But first, a word from the people who are bringing us to you.
Mack Weldon believes in smart design, premium fabrics, and simple shopping. I can say from my own experience, their website is very easy to navigate with large, clear images of all their products. Mack Weldon promises their products will be the most comfortable underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, hoodies, and sweatpants you'll ever wear. They even have a line of silver underwear and shirts that are naturally antimicrobial. Not only do Mack Weldon's underwear, socks, and shirts look good, they perform well too. Whether it's going for a workout, going out on dates, or going to work, it's a pleasure to wear. I can say from my own experience, I walk to and from work in Columbia, South Carolina about 15 to 20 minutes each day. It's been almost 100 degrees the last week with humidity to match. The nice thing about Mack Weldon is they're made from a proprietary blend of cotton, beechwood modal, and lycra. That makes them more breathable and gives them a softer feel. Also, their socks have a cushioned footbed. It makes going to and from work much more comfortable. I can also say, as someone who's 6'4", that their socks have an extended crew length. That makes them much more wearable for people who are taller. So go to MackWeldon.com, get 20% off using promo code UNDISCLOSED. They want you to be comfortable, so if you don't like your first pair, you can keep it and they'll still refund you. No questions asked. Again, that's MackWeldon.com, get 20% off using the promo code UNDISCLOSED. Now, before I send it back to John, I wanted to note that Rabia couldn't be here with us this week. She'll be back next week. The reason she couldn't be here this week is she's out promoting her forthcoming book, Adnan's Story, The Search for Truth and Justice After Serial. Now, that book officially releases August 9th, but you can pre-order it now at adnansstory.com. And as any of you who have read Rabia's blog, Split the Moon, know, she's a fantastic writer. But it's not just her words. The book contains many letters that Adnan has sent to her over the years, and this is very much Adnan telling his side of the story for the first time. So again, the book is Adnan's Story, The Search for Truth and Justice After Serial, and you can pre-order it at adnansstory.com. Now I'll send it back to John.
Okay, in this first episode, the Panama City incident, we heard about the mysterious death of Isaac Dawkins in the big, small town of Rome, Georgia, and how Joey Watkins immediately came under suspicion. So I wanted to actually address my first question to Susan. So I know that the Georgia Innocence Project brought this case to you guys, but what aspects of this case made you guys want to pursue it?
I think the biggest for me was that of all the people who contacted us and asked us to look into cases, this was the only one where the attorneys reached out to us. And I felt like in order for us to make the biggest impact we could, in order for this podcast to make a difference in a case, we needed that sort of support. We needed to have attorneys who were on board with the project and wanted this to go forward. And that's probably the first thing that caught my eye.
Yeah, and a lot of people have been asking, because it's alluded to in the podcast, that you had some special connection to Rome, Georgia. Were you sequestered there in a nunnery or something? Or how do you what is your special connection?
I've never lived there, but my mom's side of the family is from there. And most of my relatives have moved away since then or are no longer living in Rome. But growing up, I spent time, basically, most of my time in Rome was during Christmas breaks and summer breaks. My parents would drop me off the grandparents. So as an adult, I have not spent much time there until recently for this podcast.
Well, I'm sure that's a big help for you, because for me, one of the issues is I have a very hard time understanding the accents as they are presented. Policeman Stanley Sutton, unfortunately, sounds like a human didgeridoo to me. He says, and I'm sure your history there must help you in understanding what they're talking about.
I mean, it must. I haven't had a problem with it yet, but I guess it's a local thing.
See, that is amazing to me, because I listen to the Truth and Justice podcast as well, and often he'll talk about things that happen in these police interviews, and he'll play them, and I still can't understand them. And am I alone in that?
Yes. No.
Okay, great. Great. That's good to know.
On the social media, it seems that you are far from alone. And in the future, we'll try and, I guess, provide translations for
Thank you.
Certain quotes.
And Colin, were there any interesting legal aspects for this for you, or was it really just the power of the case that made you want to pursue it?
I think for me, it was a combination of the two. It's a really compelling story with a lot of interesting angles, but there are several evidentiary issues that we're going to explore. In fact, there's a huge evidentiary issue that we're developing now that might lead to a new trial. So across the board, it was something where it piqued my interest based upon my specialty in the rules of evidence.
Okay, well, we're so excited about you working the rules of evidence. We're also, I just want to say, as a fan, I'm excited about, because I've heard there is some amount of cell tower evidence that is involved here with Susan. And honestly, I have to say, cell tower evidence is like Susan Simpson's superpower. Honestly, if there was a series of Undisclosed and she wasn't going through cell tower evidence, it would be like seeing a Superman movie and not seeing him fly. So I as a fan, am grateful that you're going to be doing that. Now,
I think some fans might be feeling the opposite, but I feel like the cell phone issues in this case, they're not the same as Anon's case, and they're very fascinating in their own way. It's not a repeat of what happened for Anon. It does involve cell phone misuse by prosecutors and a misunderstanding of cell phone evidence by defense attorneys, but the issues themselves are not the same ones as we saw with Anon.
So I wanted to very quickly get to the millions of Twitter questions. Okay, that's a little bit of an exaggeration. But we had many, many questions on Twitter, and I wanted to start addressing them as quickly as we could. A lot of people had questions about the actual incident that resulted in the murder of Isaac Dawkins. Here's one from Alec Thinks Stuff. And he says, is there any way the bullet that hit the victim could have been a stray bullet from a hunting slash target practice near the road? And I want to supplement that question with a Twitter user named Kim Lord, who bombarded us with many similar questions, saying, theories for Undisclosed, suicide, sniper, passenger in car escaped. She also hit us with, did 911 calls see accident or just aftermath? And then how many gunshot wounds? How many bullets? Drive-by car? What angle was the gunshot wound? So obviously, Kim has a job as an interrogator waiting for her. But if you could explain a little more about the actual circumstances of the shooting, it would be appreciated.
I think Kim's questions are a whole episode we have planned in the future. And there's the same questions I had when I first saw the case, trying to figure out like what actually happened here. Yes, the 911 callers, or at least one of them, they didn't record who the other one was from. But one of them did see the accident, and there were a few people who didn't see everything before it, but they saw the car as it crossed into the southbound lane. But we only have one real eyewitness here who saw more than a tiny portion of the wreck, and that would be the first 911 caller.
And is it possible that it's a stray bullet from hunting or target practice nearby?
I'm still wondering that. The ballistics are a huge issue in this case. They're going to make a very large part of what we talk about. So I think I lean towards no, but I very much looked into that early on, wondering if that's possible. I have talked to people in Rome who have said that they either themselves did or knew of people who hunted deer in that area. There's like woodlands on both sides of the road, on the east side past the factories, and on the west actually right there. Supposedly there were deer, especially back in the day, in 99, 2000. So it's possible. I don't think it seems likely.
I basically break it down into three categories where it's one, someone was trying to shoot him and was successful. And for that, we'll get into the question of, well, what type of accuracy and proficiency would a shooter need to have to be able to accomplish that shot? The second is it was someone maybe with road rage blowing off steam and they were firing and unintentionally hit him. And then the third is what was suggested in this question, which is that it wasn't even someone on Route 27 itself. It was someone peripherally who was maybe shooting at a deer in the woods and a stray bullet struck the victim. So for me, at least, all three of those at this point are still on the table.
Wait, Colin, you're ruling out the Bechstein theory?
Okay, I'll bite. What?
There's other versions of events that are, I guess, on the table, but their level of plausibility is pretty low.
Well, it's such a bizarre accident, you know, for a car accident to be investigated and then suddenly turn into a shooting is unusual. So I can see why unusual theories might grow out of it.
Yeah, and there's no shortage of them in this case. There's other people who might have confessed to the crime. There are plenty of people with possible motivations, or it's not entirely clear. So there's going to be any number of theories that are going to be put out there this season as to what might have happened here.
Okay, well, I've got another question from Bishop Fianchetto, who, by the way, I hope is elected Pope next. he says, does it sound like the friends, in quotes, were recording the phone call as a way to set Joey up?
The recording was done at the request of the police, so it was part of the investigation.
Okay, that explains it. Oh, a lot of people are asking, why did the jurisdiction that was in Rome Police Department move to the Floyd County Police Department?
That is definitely an episode in itself.
Okay, yeah, it's alluded that that the family of the victim had something to do with it, but I suspect there's a bigger story there.
Yes.
Yeah, yes.
I'm trying to answer that.
Now, one thing, at the beginning of the episode, Joey himself hints very darkly at the deeds in his past that are bad in some respect. What exactly are there? I mean, at one point, the family's interviewed and they talk about shooting his dog. Well, but nothing seems actually nailed down of what are the things that he actually did that were so terrible.
We're going to get into this more next episode, but in terms of actual criminal record, I think the worst thing he had was drag racing. What he's referring to is not so much a criminal background of any sort. It's more just a reputation for getting into scraps, being a jerk. Not really a criminal sort of reputation.
Okay, so one of the things that I thought that the episode brought up that was really fascinating to me was the whole idea of the illusion of truth effect. The idea being that the reputation that Joey had as a troubled young man poisoned the atmosphere such that he was thought of as being guilty of all manner of things. Are there other examples of the illusion of truth sort of infecting a case in this way?
It affected me when I first started getting into it. I really thought that Joey was going to be like a very dark, angry figure that, you know, he would be really did have a terrible history or something. And I thought it'd be interesting to try and address that and show, like, well, it doesn't matter someone's a jerk or not. Like, it's still a wrongful conviction or not. Like, that's not relevant to what we're looking at. Because the case sets it up to be like him. He's, this, like you said, the big bad wolf. And then the more I got into it, the more I realized that it's not that the reputation was undeserved, but it is way over-exaggerated. And it's not as if he markedly stood out from the crowd he was hanging with.
Yeah, I would say, John, in researching this case, what I found in terms of the illusion of truth effect is it most often comes up in arson cases. And I think that's because arson investigations are so subjective. So there was one case out of Texas, and the arson investigator was misinformed. He believed the wife and the husband were having marital problems. They were having financial troubles. And he investigated a fire at their house, and he concluded it was an arson. And then they had someone else come in and investigate it independently and determined that it seemed to be from step one, he was looking at this a certain way based upon assumptions about their relationship and financial status, and that infected the case, whereas an objective look at the evidence from someone who wasn't aware of this fake history came to the conclusion it was an accidental fire. So, yeah, many cases where this or something similar comes up where the police get a lead, they go down a certain path, and they can't correct themselves when they determine that initial lead maybe wasn't correct.
So I wanted to direct my next question to Congressman Ellison, actually, because you've been a criminal defense attorney. Have you noticed in your criminal defense practice that this illusion of truth effect has affected cases that you've worked on?
Well, yeah. I mean, that, you know, I did criminal defense work for about 16 years. I took every kind of case, murder, rape, robbery. I was the director of the Legal Rights Center in Minneapolis, where I was glad to spend many years. And then when I went into private practice, did federal, state. And, you know, it's one of those things that explains why people come to erroneous conclusions, because we basically have a tendency to believe that the things in our life that we are repeatedly exposed to are in fact true and therefore don't challenge our underlying assumptions. So it's kind of a recurring theme. And when we think about, you know, how somebody can be convicted unlawfully or without the basis of being actually guilty, it's these sort of assumptions that we operate on. So I have a case, you know, where that I have my defendant started out being a person who was in prison, and he was accused of participating in a murder when two gangbanging groups were shooting it out on the street. And my particular client, because he would come out of he would come out into the courtroom from inside of the courtroom. The jury even was aware that he was in custody. They knew that he was in prison based on the testimony. And they just sort of assumed that if he was in prison for something else or he was in custody, that he probably, you know, belonged there, which I think is a version, you know, of the illusion of truth effect. So I just think it's one of those operative things that probably explains a lot of reasons why we see people who get wrongfully convicted.
Well, I was wondering if there was also sort of a social effect to it, that in smaller towns where the police often know the people they feel are part of the so-called criminal element, they often direct their investigations at those people because it feels like a part of the social knowledge of this small town that those are the trouble ones and they're probably responsible for whatever crimes occur. Have you experienced that?
No doubt. So let me tell you, in St. Paul, there was a case where the police actually did a study where they found that black men were arrested most for shoplifting, but were shoplifting, in fact, the least, and that white females were shoplifting the most. People had an idea in their head that certain kind of people shoplift and certain people don't. Some people are law-abiding, some people are not. And guess what? Everybody knows that, quote unquote. And so, yeah, no question about it. If you are sort of considered, you know, outside of the circle of the trusted ones, if you're in the outside group, you've just increased your likelihood of being suspected, of being suspicious, right? And it's something that every defense attorney better be on the alert for. And we probably should voir dire jurors on this issue and get them to start really challenging some of their fundamental assumptions from the very beginning of the case, because it is with those basic assumptions that they will use to understand the evidence.
Yes, one of the more famous examples of the illusion of truth for me was I grew up in New York City, and part of the sort of mythology of New York City was the Kitty Genovese case, which was a case in 1964 where a woman was attacked and raped and murdered, while 38 bystanders supposedly watched and did nothing. And this was, of course, incredibly scandalous at the time and was used as evidence that the social fabric of New York City was frayed and that we had become a bystander culture where we, you know, nobody will help anybody. And that story stood until 2007 when somebody finally went through the actual evidence and discovered that actually, it was only about five or six people who had actually heard the incident. One of them actually yelled at the assailant and got him to run off and stop his attack. He later came back and continued it. But and another neighbor actually stayed with the victim and consoled her until the ambulance arrived. So this was actually not a case of that, but it became part of the urban mythos.
But everybody knew it, right? It was one
exactly.
of those, it wasn't true that everyone knew. And you know, it reminds me of that civil case in which people would try to sort of trivialize civil redress by saying, oh, well, somebody got $1 million by suing McDonald's for hot coffee. In fact, that case is way more complicated than that. It was an older, very delicate woman. They had been warned many, many times. And there was a whole real case that would lead one logically to say, well, maybe McDonald's at least should warn people that the coffee is really super hot. And maybe juries are not just handing out $1 million just because of hot coffee. But it just kind of became the kind of like exhibit A that our civil redress system was just wild, just passing out money all the time, and that there was no real justice for people who were a defendant in a civil case. You know, these things get into our culture. And, you know, obviously in this particular case that we're talking about today, the Joey Watkins case, it just became to be a matter of assumption that he was dangerous to the victim in this case, and that people just sort of passed it around until it was sort of like one of in the fabric and the basic, you know, legend of the town.
I think a lot of wrongful convictions are that sort of fit this mold of where there's a moral panic and a defendant is found that for whatever reason fits the trope, fits this like caricature of a bad guy that the moral panic is centered around. And you can see it with the West Memphis Three when they had satanic panic going around, wherever it was. There's this fear of young men or people worshiping the devil and Satan and trying to do dark arts or who knows what. So when this murder happens, this tragic murder, they make it fit that mold, and they find three kind of not fitting the norm, like young men in the community, and they decide that they're Satan worshipers. It happened with the man in Knox, and not a U.S. case, but it does seem very much like the media saw this seductress American female who was like living a lavish, like a total hedonistic life, and with sex and like murder and drugs, and she fit that profile so well, she became the defendant.
It fit the idea that Europeans had of Americans at the time as well.
So what do we do about this? We know that there is this illusory effect here, and we know it exists. It's been documented from a defense standpoint, from a prosecutorial standpoint. What do we do? Is this a matter of voir dire? Is this a matter of instructions from the judge? How do we go about making sure that there's a fair trial and that these hidden assumptions and biases don't sort of like stow away into the case?
Well, as the guy who played Alan on Two and a Half Men, I think, no, I have no idea what we should do. I have nothing. Colin, Susan, do you have better ideas than the guy on Two and a Half Men?
For me, the best way to approach it is just to make sure that these shorthand notations that evoke larger ideas and fears aren't relied on, aren't used. Don't use the small town bully who wanted to beat everyone up trope and break it down to the actual facts. Because when people hear these key words that trigger like their biases and past stories, it's not even just prejudices, it's like past narratives ingrained in their head. And once that's triggered, it's off to the races. So trying to break that down and actually show, well, here's what factually happened. Yes, you could make it fit this larger narrative that we're scared of, whatever it might be that time. But I do think getting back to the facts and looking at the reality situation can help sort of dispel that illusion of truth.
Our part of the facts of the case, it's just that they're not legitimate facts in the case. They're evidence that is accepted as true that isn't necessarily true and that isn't necessarily even part of the proof to make out the elements of the case. It seems to me that the defense attorney and the judge and probably the prosecutor, to make sure the trial is fair, have to try to identify these, I'll call these stowaway facts that sort of just get embedded because they're repeatedly heard, and sort of confront them from the very beginning. And maybe they need to be confronted. Maybe you should have an instruction. Maybe there needs to be some voir dire on this point. I don't know. I think it's worthwhile talking about.
I do think podcasts like Undisclosed do highlight these subjects. I learned so much from the Truth and Justice podcast when he talked about false confessions. I did not know that they were so prevalent in convictions, and that 25% of DNA exonerations, the conviction resulted from a false confession, which means you can extrapolate that out and say 25% of confessions are probably false. But that's a fact I would not have known if not for these justice-based podcasts.
Yeah, that's why I'm glad to be on here with you guys, because I believe that this is helping create a higher quality of justice. And, when you look at – we've had a record number of people exonerated in 2015, well over 100 people. I mean, if we're ever going to have our criminal justice system be respected, then it's going to have to be trusted. And that means we're going to have to learn how to do the process of justice better. And I think Undisclosed is a very important part of that.
Yeah, and I think from an evidentiary perspective, a lot of this goes back to the rules regarding character evidence. Character evidence is evidence of a person's reputation, their prior bad acts. And historically, it was disfavored because originally it was back in England under the Tudors and the Stuarts. They had the Star Chamber and they had a paucity of evidence in a lot of cases, and they used this character evidence to convict. And that led the U.S. to eventually say, listen, we don't want character evidence coming in. But that said, a person's prior convictions can come in to show they're lacking in credibility as a witness. And that actually leads to a lot of defendants not testifying because they know the jurors are going to overvalue those prior convictions. And even though character evidence can come in to prove, well, generally this is a violent guy or this is a dishonest guy or this is a bad guy, there are so many exceptions, we'll explore many of them in this case, that allow this character evidence to come in. And it's tough. I know the congressman mentioned voir dire, which is the questions to the jury during jury selection. A judge can give limiting instructions to the jury, but actually studies often show, pursuant to with the illusory truth effect, that whether it's consumers being given warnings or jurors being given instructions, that in fact it often only highlights that they could use the evidence for an impermissible purpose or they could draw negative inferences for a product. So it's so tough. I really think that the main thing that courts need to do is take a long, hard look at the extent to which character evidence is admissible at trials, and I think it comes in far too often.
Well, when you talk about prior conviction evidence, I've been in this situation many times where my client wanted to testify, go to the jury, look him in the eye and deny doing what he was or she was accused of. But, that prior conviction, even though it had absolutely nothing to do with the facts in front of the jury, oftentimes it made it a much tougher call. And I remember a number of defendants who just said, I'm not going to testify because I don't want him to bring that up. But I will tell you this, there were a number of cases also where my client did want to testify, and I always took the attitude that if you want to testify, then I would probably advise against it. But if you really are committed to, it's your case and you have a right to do it, I would often bring that conviction out. First, I'd make a motion to suppress it. If that didn't work, then I'd preserve the record and all, but then I'd be the one to maybe say, you have a prior conviction. Yeah, and then just sort of look the jury in the eye and say it has nothing to do with this. But yeah, I did at one time steal some donuts from Super America. Have nothing to do with the case, but I don't know. Does it help to get it out in front of the jury and to confront it? And I don't know. I kind of think that there's different ways of looking at it.
Yeah, as a juror, that donut thing would really put me over the edge. I have a real issue with people taking baked goods. That's my thing. I've served on a jury a couple of times, and I have found that when people are very upfront, it really does diffuse the issue for jurors. I had a civil trial where a fire inspector admitted fully that he had had a traffic accident, that he was not paying attention when he had the traffic accident. We were all very grateful for that on the jury. And it did really reinforce the rest of his the honesty of his testimony at that point. I like those admonitions that the judge gives about how we have to view things. I have found that it really does make people at least think twice about imposing a bias on something.
John, that's interesting that you mentioned that, because there's a Supreme Court case, the Oler case. And some of the things we've been talking about here, such as, let's say, a defendant's on trial for murder and they have a prior conviction for shoplifting or tax fraud or vandalism. What the Oler case says is, if the defendant and defense counsel do exactly what you're suggesting on direct examination, they say, listen, before you testify about this murder, let's just get this out there. 5 years ago, you were convicted of shoplifting, and they elicit that during direct examination. What that means is, according to the Supreme Court, you cannot appeal that issue to an appellate court. So in other words, if you wait for the prosecution on cross-examination to bring out that conviction, you can appeal it and say, this was improper for the jury to consider. But if you do exactly what you said and you try to lessen the blow by listing it yourself, you cannot appeal that and say that the jury should not have considered this conviction in the case.
So that's why they don't do it very much, I would imagine.
Right, to catch 22. Yeah.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah, it's too bad that the court would take a position like that, because obviously, if the goal of the trial is to get all the facts out, that kind of ruling actually prevents facts from getting out, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, I was going to add on, if we're speaking of the illusory truth effect and all the facts getting in, the most classic example of the illusory truth effect that I use in class is the so-called Twinkie defense. That's the case where Dan White killed Harvey Milk in San Francisco. And there was a defense known as diminished capacity that said, if you have depression, maybe borderline personality disorder, you're still guilty, but it's sort of a lesser guilt than full-blown guilt. And he had his psychiatrist testify to several things pointing to his depression, including the fact that he was eating a lot of junk food. And the media labeled this the Twinkie defense, where the claim was misreported as he had a sugar high from eating a bunch of Twinkies, and that's why he claimed he shot Harvey Milk. And it led to, across the country, most states getting rid of the diminished capacity defense. And there's a pretty big link between mental illness and crime, and both in response to that as well as the assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan, that led to a lot of states changing their insanity defense rules. And again, it's based upon sort of these misimpressions of a lot of these issues that criminal defendants face in many cases.
Well, yeah, like in that the McDonald's civil case that you mentioned, that woman got third degree burns. That's some hot coffee. I'm sorry. So they're often a lot of the times, one of the things, as I said, that I'm really grateful about the podcast for is when you get into the minutiae of the trial, you start to understand why things happen the way that they do. And so maybe, you know, a difference is being made slowly but surely. And actually, Congressman Ellison, I wanted to bring up the thing I brought up at the beginning of the show, which was that you know, obviously it's been an awful week, and I feel like much of what we've been witnessing is due to an egregious breakdown in the relationship between the police and the people that they're there to protect. And I know that there's actually been some legislation introduced recently to take steps to address that, including police de-escalation training and use of force standard. But I'm hearing that there's actually been pushback on that. So can you let us know what's the status of the legislation?
We've had a number of conversations, like the two items that you just mentioned. Also, there's a program called COPS, which is community-oriented policing funding. There's been some bipartisan discussion around increasing that to try to make sure that we can get officers out of the cars and really engage community much more. And then, of course, there's the recurring dialogue around body cams. And, you know, it's funny. In the area of criminal justice, the environment is very different the way it was than the way it was, say, 10 years ago. 10 years ago, if you were a politician, you had to be tough on crime. If you're a Democratic politician, you had to be tougher on crime than the Republicans were, which is really what helped drive the war on drugs, is this competition to be tougher on crime. But we're in a different place today. Today, Republicans and Democrats are talking about reducing drug sentences. We're talking about reforming asset forfeiture. We're talking about making sure that we get rid of mandatory minimum sentencing. So there is a range of things that we're looking at doing. And so we've had some preliminary conversations, but at this point, just getting anything done is not easy. And by the way, we don't have that many legislative days. I mean, by the end of the week, we'll be out for the summer recess and be gone back in our districts, talking to constituents there in the district, for about 7 weeks. Then we'll be back in September, have about 4 weeks of legislation, and then a little bit in October. Then there's the election. And in the lame duck, nobody expects that much to get done either. But we're going to keep on pressing. And I just want to say to people listening to the podcast, if you want your member of Congress to do something about criminal justice reform, police community relations, call them. It does make a huge difference. We check our mail and our emails every day and our calls. And the only way to really get reform here is when constituents consistently demand it. So I don't want to sound too pessimistic. And I think that the way to reverse that pessimism and get some things done is to really engage constituents.
It's just hard to get political support for a platform of make it harder to convict bad guys.
Well, you know, here's the thing, though. I mean, we are talking about lifting mandatory minimums, and this is a bipartisan thing. We are talking about reducing drug sentences. We had this disparity of 100-to-1 sentencing disparity between crack and powder cocaine, as you guys well know. Well, you know, during the time I served in Congress, we reduced it to 18-to-1, which is not what I think justice requires, but it's better than what it was. Even in this, there's a criminal justice reform bill right now, which would retroactively, if passed, retroactively reduce drug sentencing for nonviolent cocaine, crack cocaine offenders, and might even let as many as 5,000 people out of prison. There's bipartisan authors on both. And so I think we're in a new political moment. I think the tough on crime mantra has passed. And if we're going to get something done, it might be within the next few years.
I feel like tough on crime is itself an illusion of truth.
Yeah. It's something that's repeated over and over and over again and assumed to be right, but it's wrong.
Well, it comes out of a climate of fear, a climate of abject terror. And when you feel like your politicians are tough, that somehow makes you feel slightly better, even if it doesn't actually accomplish the goal that it was meant for. And for me, you know, when I hear about legislation like that would require police de-escalation training, it's like we're trying to give cops another tool. You know, they've got their gun, they've got their taser. Let's give them a tool to not let this get violent. And let's, you know, and I'm sure there are plenty of people out there wondering why this is, you know, it feels like a no-brainer. But I'm hoping actually for criminal justice reform to also take some of the load off of the justice system, which is so overburdened at this point. I mean, the Sixth Amendment requiring a speedy trial has become kind of ridiculous. I mean, like if you look at Adnan Syed's case, the process has become the punishment. He's in jail for 17 years. It should have played out much, much faster than it did.
This is fast. Adnan's case is super fast. It's a sad thing.
That's the sad thing. And I, by the way, the job of the court is not to do it fast. It's to get it right, which I understand. And there's so many layers of the bureaucracy at this point. But I feel like if we can end the war on drugs, we can take the burden off of the justice system just from the sheer amount of stuff that they deal with. I think that is a great start.
I think you're absolutely on the right track, because if the system just took fewer cases in, you could focus on the cases that you have. You look at a public defense office like that in New Orleans. I mean, they're so overburdened. I mean, it's hard to even make the claim that your average defendant in New Orleans is getting anything close to justice. I mean, it's totally an abrogation of everything of Gideon versus Wainwright ever was supposed to represent. And they're not the only ones. There's all kinds of weighted case studies across the country where public defense systems are just not able to keep up with the volume. I mean, how many people who were charged with stuff that they didn't do pled because they said you've been in jail for 2 weeks already and you're too poor to bail out, but if you plead to it, you can get out today? How often does that happen?
And then these people have to live with the record that they now have built because they had to do the expedient thing at that moment. And it just adds to itself, yeah.
And we act like only guilty people plead guilty. Now, that is absolutely absurd. We definitely are on another kind of trajectory than tough on crime nowadays. I think that just the massive numbers of people exonerated is helping to move the political environment in another kind of direction. I just want to urge everybody to keep their eyes on some of these criminal justice reform bills, bipartisan bills that are working their way through the House. It is sort of a bright light, an uncertain light, but a bright light in an otherwise dim situation.
I am likely too pessimistic, but this is part of why I like doing the podcast so much, because at times it does seem so overwhelming, and the process and the system is too big. But at least with this, I can focus on one problem and take a step forward there. Hopefully, in the bigger picture, that can help lead to change elsewhere, but you start looking at all the issues currently facing the criminal justice system, and it does feel too big to attack at times.
See, the public is seeing their loved ones go to do real time for meth, for cocaine, for crack, for all kind of things. I mean, this country puts a lot of people in prison, you know, 2.5 million people, more people than China, even though we're one-third the population of China. And it really is weighing on our shoulders. I was binge watching Orange is the New Black the other day in fourth season. And one of the things that is so interesting about that show is that you got this white Smith graduate doing time, something we didn't used to see before. The prison industrial complex has invaded upper middle class America.
Well, I think we also, consumers of media culture, have become way too comfortable seeing celebrity mugshots. Hopefully, you will never see one of mine. But on a serious note, it does normalize the idea that everybody gets arrested sooner or later, which that shouldn't be normal. I don't think that should be normal.
Every other country in the world gets by with incarcerating a tiny fraction of what we do. So does that mean we're better or something? We're just like way better at incarcerating?
We are. Well, we're so good at it.
We have an industry.
We're awesome.
It's an industry.
Industry. That's what we do.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an industry. But polls do show majority of Americans are open to reevaluating sentencing laws. I mean, a lot of people think that we're not doing the right thing. I remember the early 90s, late 80s, when, you know, a lot of how the criminal justice system worked, you know, was racialized. Today, that's not really the case. I mean, people get that this thing has gone out of control. You get a guy like Bernard Kerik, you know, a top policing official, end up going to prison, something that we never saw before, and then able to come out and talk about the problems with the criminal justice system and how it's really not making us safer, although it just seems like we're locking up more and more and more people. I remember when I was a state legislator, a very conservative, small government conservative guy, and a guy named Eric Lippman, co-authored an op-ed in the Minneapolis Star Tribune saying we should cut sentencing and put the money into treatment. He said we should also put some of the money into tax reduction, like a fine conservative would suggest. And you know what? We were roundly attacked by everybody, liberals, conservatives, everybody. Nowadays, that's a conversation you can have. There's going to be a lot more pushing that needs to happen. But every time you see somebody exonerated, getting off death row, I think it builds the case a little bit more. Every time, you know, undisclosed heirs and we see that, you know, that there is a lot more support for real criminal justice reform.
And I think one thing I'd like to show with this season is that, I mean, obviously, there are a lot of issues in Baltimore, but this isn't like a big city thing. It's not like a Baltimore thing. It's not a specific police department or a specific area. It's all around the nation. Small towns, large cities, the same things happen again and again.
Well, I want to tell you, that's why I'm glad you guys picked out Joey Watkins' case, because I think when people think criminal justice reform, they're thinking big city, people of color, low income, drugs, guns, all that. The truth is, Joey Watkins' case is actually has a degree of typical to it. You know, there really are many people from small town America, rural America, suburban America who are in prison, who are charged with crimes, who the evidence is very questionable and quite shaky and built on some untrustworthy assumptions. You know, whoever selected this case did a good job, because I think it really is going to help reinforce who's in prison. And that the fact that the quality of evidence that is convicting people really, really must be higher without regard to, you know, whether Joey really did it or didn't do it. The evidence, I think we probably all would agree, is thin.
One of Joey's previous attorneys told me, if it can happen to Joey, it can happen to anyone.
Good point.
Yeah, and we've been focusing a lot on that first crime or the first arrest or conviction, but another huge part of the puzzle is America's recidivism rate. And the Bureau of Justice Statistics has looked into this and found, I think the most recent data that I use in class, it was a study of prisoners from 30 states, and I think it was 67.8% were rearrested within 3 years of release, and 76.6% were rearrested within 5 years. Those rates are just much higher than they are in many other countries, and it leads to the question, of course, of what are we doing in terms of both the quantity and quality of criminal sentences in America that contributes to these higher recidivism rates where people are reoffending when they've been released?
Well, let me ask you this. If you were to disaggregate those numbers and unpack them a little bit, how many of those are just probation and parole violations, which might be anything from like missing a meeting with your PO or having a UA with some THC in it or new cases?
Okay, Keith, I have no idea what you just said.
Oh, sorry.
A UA with some THC in it? I need
That's
to,
weed.
It's weed. Oh, great. Oh, see, I need to do more drugs. That's the problem. Thank you, Congressman, for filling
me in. For the
record,
THC is weed, but I only know that because I study this stuff.
Okay. Yes, thank you. Thank you. I don't want to instigate a scandal here, but go ahead, Colin. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I do have some of those statistics. So in the case of drug offenders, the recidivism rate is 77%. Violent offenders, it's 71%. Depends. Property offenses, I think about 62.5% I'm seeing. So it does vary crime to crime. It's certainly, if not the highest, drug crimes is up there in the recidivism rates. And there have been numerous articles and studies done about the lack of effective narcotics treatment programs. And then in terms of what's going on in halfway houses, people reintegrate back into society. I think certainly the drug epidemic is tied to the over-imprisonment issue. And I think that if you're going to address the one, you have to address the other because they're so intertwined.
And incarceration for minor parole violations plays a role in this case, too.
Well, yeah.
Are people going back because of a dirty UA? That's your analysis, you know.
Thank you.
sorry about that. Or are they going back because they committed a new crime?
Or they forget to pay a fine or forget to be on time to a meeting.
Well, and I actually have a question. I read something recently that blew my mind, that John Ehrlichman, former aide to Richard Nixon, of Watergate fame, actually admitted that the drug war was escalated by President Nixon specifically with the aim of disenfranchising black voters and leftists, he specifically aimed at it. Now, am I the only one who heard this? Because this was a bombshell for me.
That's out there.
That's a pretty remarkable admission, because that the tone certainly changed with the Nixon administration, and it has had devastating effects on the African-American population, exactly apparently as he predicted, which is so disturbing.
Yeah, you know, just for folks who want to dig into it more, you know, Richard Nixon's aide, you know, admitted the war on drugs was a policy tool to go after anti-war protesters and black people. But it is something that absolutely needs to be explored. You know, this is when we really started cranking up drug crimes. We really started, you know, saying that you had crack babies. That's another, I think, illusion of truth kind of thing.
Absolutely.
And super predators. I remember the super predator scare. That was my favorite.
Yeah, and it was driven by all of this stuff. And, you know, you would think that there'd be some accountability, but that story you just referenced, it just seemed like there was a 1 or 2 day story and then it was out of the news.
I missed it. My excuse is I've been busy with Joey's case, but that's news to me.
I just pulled it up and it's interesting because I don't know, but I'm looking and there's this story, and I guess the children of Ehrlichman, who has passed away, are refuting it because it wasn't included in the initial story. So this could be accurate, or it could be another example of illusory truth. I'm not sure, but I hadn't read it myself. But looking at the article, it's something where there does seem to be a debate. But yeah, I don't know.
Now, and Colin, I just want to let you know, I have not let you off the hook. I'm going to give you crud about the bombshell once more. But I've decided what I'm going to do is try to like ask you an innocuous question and then insert it. So like, okay, like this, like, hey, Colin, what's your favorite sports team?
Jets.
What's the bombshell? I don't know if that worked or not. but I wanted to thank you guys. This is my first episode of the addendum, and it's been great. And I admire what you guys do. I thought the first episode was awesome. And I'm really looking forward to learning a lot more about Joey. Thanks for your time today.
I was really relieved when I got your email, because you were probably one of the first people who's totally like not part of the process to listen to it. And you always wonder like what the outcome was like from the outside. And I saw your email. I was like, all right, we got one fan on board.
the most important one, of course, I'm concerned. But yes, it's again, I think what you're doing is important. But the fact that you do it so well is remarkable. So thank you for doing what you do. So when they approached me about hosting the show, they very kindly offered me a fee. And honestly, I consider it an honor to be a part of this. So I wanted to use it to highlight organizations that are helping people who may be wrongfully convicted. So every week, what I'd like to do is I'm going to donate my fees to one of these organizations. And the first one I'd like to do is the Jeffrey Descovic Foundation for Justice, which Jeffrey Descovic was convicted of the rape and murder of his classmate, but he was fully exonerated after 16 years in prison. And he went on to start his foundation, and it helps those who the criminal justice system has let down, especially those for whom a DNA exoneration is not possible. You can find them, if you'd like to give, at descovic.org. Fans can discuss the show on Twitter at #undisclosed or #JoeyWatkins. If you want to tag questions for future addenda, you can use #UDAddendum. And you can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the handle @UndisclosedPod. And also our key partner, the Georgia Innocence Project at GA Innocence. I want to thank Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the Crime Writers On podcast for audio production, and also Hannah McCarthy for her help. And I want to thank Patrick Cortez for composing the new addenda theme, Methil Telhan as our project manager, and Mac Weldon for sponsoring us. But mostly, I want to thank you for giving our new format a try. Thanks, and we will talk again next week. Hi, is Congressman the way you'd like to be addressed, I would imagine?
No, I'm happy to be addressed as Keith Ellison.
Okay, sure. I could do Your Honor. I could do Your Highness. I could do...
Your Majesty?
Yes, exactly. I can go a lot of different directions with this.